Hey, this is Eric Stewart. With over 25 years in the human resource field, working for organizations like Royal Caribbean, Celebrity Cruises, Norwegian Cruise Lines, and Club Med, I know a thing or two about HR, especially within the hospitality industry. And if you want to learn how to transform your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, significantly increase your revenue, and create scalable sales systems, you should be listening to the Authentic Persuasion Show with my good friend, Jason Cutter.
Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show, a place where business and thought leaders come to weigh in on important sales-related topics that you can use in your sales career and life. I'm your host, Jason Cutter. My mission is to get your help in changing sales from something prospects fear to an act of service they actually seek out and appreciate. Whether you're in sales, leading sales teams, or own a business, I hope this helps you improve your selling effectiveness and you can go out into the world as an authentic persuader. Hey, everybody, and welcome to another guest episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show. My special guest today, his name is Eric Stewart. So Eric spent over 25 years in the human resources field before doing what he does now as a consultant. He worked for some companies most people might recognize, like Royal Caribbean, which is actually my parents' favorite cruise line, and Celebrity Cruises, Norwegian Cruise Lines, where he managed the recruiting, scheduling functions for the crew in over 50 countries, which a lot of people don't realize how much of a global workforce it takes and is involved in those kind of cruise lines. So he knows a bit of recruiting and hiring and managing all of that. Prior to that, he served as the VP of Human Resources for Club Med, overseeing Miami corporate office, as well as 22 other locations in the Western Hemisphere. He's worked with manufacturing companies all over the place. He holds a science degree and a certification in personnel management and employee relations. And I have him here today because I'm super fascinated about the things that he's done, his experience in HR, and the insights I know that he has from what he's seen that apply to any organization, specifically where I focus on sales teams and companies. So I know this is going to be super fun. Eric, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Well, terrific. Thanks for having me, Jason.
So like I said, I am excited because you have obviously experience in a wide range, a lot of it hospitality based, which of course will address the elephant in the room, which is that hospitality, travel, all of those things, a bit of a rough year in 2020, which obviously affects you as a HR consultant and strategist for companies. But there's so much that comes from those industries and any industry that you apply. It's just fundamentals. That's what I love about the stuff that you focus on and what we've talked about before is it's just fundamentals.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I've worked in several different industries and they all are unique in some form or fashion, but they have a lot more in common than they actually are willing to admit and even understand. And in human resources, people aren't vastly different across one organization versus another. They have different hard skills, but people issues, people problems, what motivates them, what makes them walk away. I mean, those things don't change. And even with today's technology, we haven't changed the basic human being and those needs haven't changed. So you'd be surprised the learnings you can take from one industry and apply it across another one.
Which I think is fascinating because on one side, my brain wants to object and say, no, everybody is different, right? It's one of the big themes of everything I've been doing recently is help leaders realize everyone is different. So you've got to coach and manage and motivate everybody to their own needs. But I also completely agree with you is that when you go high enough up and you peel back some of the layers, people are individual, but the themes, the issues, the triggers, the things that usually cause, let's say, the issues with the humans, right, that HR then has to deal with, is pretty common themes.
I can tell you study after study that one prevailing super thought that comes across from everybody, they all have good reasons why they joined a particular company. But when you examine why they left the company, it's generally because of their boss, their direct supervisor. So people join companies, but they leave supervisors and managers. And that cuts across every industry. So there's one of those universals, whether you like it or not. Your boss, your supervisor, the person you interact with on a day-to-day basis has probably the single greatest impact on how well you feel about what you're doing and where you're doing it.
That's the end result, right? So one of the things that we're going to talk about under this whole umbrella that I wanted to address is turnover, right? I mean, you look at the positive, fine, retention. But generally what happens, you have a retention situation or a turnover situation, especially sales organizations. That's a common theme. Hospitality, I know that's a common theme. in those realms. And so the end result is watching out for a turnover retention issue. But what is interesting is how a lot of organizations say, well, we just want to get our people to stay. But that starts a long time before that moment in time. So let's start there. Let's talk about what do you see as the most vital first step to address a retention issue?
Right. So many times in organizations, or I would say almost every organization I've been in, they have turnover retention problems, but they always think it's a recruiting problem. Why can't our recruiting team just hire more, faster, quicker, and all our problems will be solved? And in many cases, when we do that, the turnover continues or even accelerates. So there's some other considerations that you have to look at the front end, because if you don't get the front end right, the rest really won't work well. So a couple of things that I like to talk with hiring managers is, what's your strategy? Is this a build or a buy? That's a very fundamental question. So, and let's just talk about salespeople just as an example. Are you going out to find an experienced salesperson that's worked in your industry and comes with almost all the tools such that you can go plug and play? You're going to have to pay market or probably slightly above market for that person, but they'll become productive relatively quickly. The other is the build phase, where you say, well, I don't want to have to untrain people with bad habits. I would rather get somebody maybe right out of college. Maybe they don't have the skills, but they also don't have the bad habits. And so I can infuse them with our habits and our culture. But now we're going to have to develop a training program and a development program. It could be weeks, could be months, and it could even be years. But the likelihood, if it's done right, is much higher retention. So that's the first question I ask. Do you have a build strategy or do you have a buy strategy? And then one of the statistics that, again, cuts across all the industries, and people are always shocked when I mention this, but when we look at studies of people that have voluntarily left a company, have quit, whatever, left within 3 years, 9 out of 10 of those failures aren't based on hard skills, meaning they were brought in, yes, they had the right degree, yes, they had the right skill sets, but where they failed was about the fit and the culture of the organization. And that's where your big failure comes in. Many times we're so focused on those hard skills. Do they have the right education? Do they have the right experience in the right industry? But we're not looking at the fit and the culture of your organization. And that's the biggest miss. And that's where you see most of your turnover in the 0 to 3 years. It's a miss on the culture fit. And that's where you need to try and spend a little more time and study and understand what works best for you and your organization.
Well, and I think that culture fit as the reason why, if somebody leaves an organization voluntarily or involuntarily in those 3 years, it could be culture fit. I think the big caveat, and correct me on this if I'm wrong, is as long as the organization has done everything they can in the training, in the leadership, in the coaching categories, right? Because one of the things I've seen is that if, as a company, you're having to let someone go or somebody leaves, if you didn't do everything you could or should have done to support them, then it's your fault as an organization.
In fact, from a human resources standpoint, I've always said to my team, if we lose people in under 18 months, I take that as a failure on our part. We failed to do something. If they're leaving at 3, 4, 5 years out, there's something else that fell short. But yeah, we're missing something at the front end on the recruiting side. And it may mean we need to go back in as recruiters to understand more about the culture. Or it could be the hiring manager is, look, you're putting way too much emphasis on these hard skills and you're missing these other things. Mm-hmm. But then the next question becomes, so if you get a manager who's a little more enlightened and says, you know what, I've had some bad experiences, I've gotten the people with the right hard skills, but I'm missing on the fit. Help me to understand, how can I interview people? And everybody's on their best behavior. These kids coming out of college are so sharp and they're so well rehearsed. How am I supposed to figure out whether they're going to fit my culture? Because they've probably studied the company and they've already got the canned answer. So how am I supposed to work this? I don't know how to do it. So it's a very old answer and it still holds true today. And it's called behavioral-based interviewing. And the theory is very simple. The best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. So if you can understand how a candidate worked in the past and what they did under specific conditions and situations, there's a likelihood they will repeat that same thing in your company under the same conditions. So it's not a question of asking canned answers or asking these tricky questions and try to catch people on things. It's all about saying, hey, I enjoy interviewing salespeople in particular because they're always pushing so hard. But I'll say, tell me a time when you had to meet objections and what did you do with that? And really what you're trying to say, well, when I have that, no, I want a specific example. Take a moment. Give me an example of a customer where you were hitting a wall and what did you do? And then ultimately, what was the result of those actions? There's a little game called STAR. And believe it or not, it's simple, but a lot of people get tripped up on it. You're asking for a situation or task. You want an answer, action, and a result. So you're asking a question. You're saying, give me an example when, what did you do, and what was the ultimate outcome? And again, not a theoretical outcome. Well, if that happened, I would do, no, tell me a time when it happened. And then for salespeople, because they tend to come in very confident, I like to throw them off. And it's always, tell me a time when you failed. And that tends to push them back a little bit. And to some extent, as a recruiter, I'm not that interested in the content, but I'm watching to see how honest they are. And I want a specific example. Don't make it up. I can tell if you see people saying, well, let me think about it. All right, there was one client. I did all these things and it still failed. So the action, maybe they did everything they could and it didn't work. But then I'll ask, okay, so what did you learn from that? Should that ever happen again? I learned this, 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 and this. Great. So now I've got someone who can face adversity. And even when they fail, they'll take a learning from it and they'll put that into their mind and then they'll take it forward. That's a good salesperson. I like that. And that's the kind of behavioral-based interviewing you're looking. Have 5 or 6 good questions like that. And that's about all you're going to need in an interview other than the intro and the closing. Let them talk. Hear what they say. Find out what they did.
Well, and I love that. And my first reaction, because I've seen the stuff that you've written and put together, and I've seen that, and I've heard you talk about that before, which is the past behavior is an indication of the future behavior and the way that you put it. A lot of self-help, motivational, like goal setting people will say the opposite of that, is that past behavior is no indication or requirement for future, right? Like what you've done in the past doesn't mean you have to repeat that. And I think that's true if you want to shift. However, most people will be who they are and do what they've done, usually unless something radical happens. They hit some kind of rock bottom or they really want to make a shift in their life. Most people don't stop a bad habit until they hit that rock bottom. And so I love what you said, if we put it in that context, which is unless you really want to change your sales style, your personality, your behavior, your actions and activities, what you did before and how you handle the situation, especially when you get punched in the face, is what's going to happen next time you get punched in the face, right? Yeah. Which is all about sales.
I'm here interviewing. I'm not your life coach. So no. I'm glad that you want to make all these changes in your life, but I want a demonstration of what you've done specifically to make that change. So sometimes when I'm counseling, I've done some work at local churches and helping people get reemployed. And some folks have some really sad stories and they've gone through some horrible life-changing events. They've lost jobs, et cetera. And they say, I don't know how to present this to an employer because of these things. But quite frankly, we sit down and we talk about it and we say, but what did you learn from it? And now you can take a negative and turn it into a positive and say, I did this, this, and this, and I made a big mistake. But what I've learned is this, and this is what I've been doing since then. And you can take even a negative situation and flip it into a positive. So I don't call it a trick, but it's a way of never letting your background slow you down. You've got some successes. Great. Talk about them. But your failures are also very interesting from a recruiting standpoint because we're trying to understand the fit and what you've come across. And if you can take that story in an authentic way and make it, you know, here's my learning, then actually you'll probably find me bonding to you and selling you to the hiring manager saying, hey, this person faced some adversity and God love them. And they may not have enough of the experience, but let me tell you, the drive that this person has, the authenticity, the work ethic, we should give them a shot. And that's what I love. That's exciting stuff.
And for anybody listening who might be catching this conversation, you're looking for a job or you're going to get a new job at some point, you're thinking about this. I think this is so important because I'll talk about it from an HR or from a hiring manager perspective. Is a good hiring manager and anyone in HR will figure it out. We will find the holes, right? You will not be able to cover up the holes if there's a gap in the resume. That's the only thing that stands out. Nothing else matters. Like, you just delete everything else. Just highlight that gap. So yep. Hiding it will never work from somebody who's good at what they do of trying to find somebody. So don't hide it. Just talk about it and bring it up. And then the other part that I would say, because this is what I've seen a lot, is if you embrace what happened in your past, the failures, the mistakes, I've had them. I'm pretty sure you've had them. We've all had them. That's life. If you're alive, you failed. You've messed up some stuff. Is if you embrace those, you do your STAR method, which is, I understand what happened. There was a result. I understand what I learned from it. And somebody still doesn't want to hire you, then perfect. That's great. Because if they're not open enough to take you on their team and they couldn't see that as a valuable like lesson that you learned, you don't want to be there anyway.
It's an important point. As an outside candidate, you truly don't know what it means to be an employee there. You can read a little bit about their culture. You can ask questions about it. But the hiring manager, the HR people, they know what their culture is. So if they ultimately, you've been authentic, you've been great, and they decide to pass on you, well, let me tell you, it's not a good fit for you. And be thankful that they don't want you, because someone down the road wants you where you will be a good fit. The other one that you and I have talked about in the past, and I like to bring it up in his example of fit, is the hospitality gene. That's one of my favorite topics. We talk about this in the hospitality world, whether it be in hotel or in cruising. We're talking about people who have an authentic and genuine desire and need to serve others. They want to do it. They enjoy doing it. So whether it's the waiter, the bartender, it doesn't matter. You've all been to hotels where you've walked in and you get a warmth from someone greeting you, and you know it's genuine. And you've also had the reverse. And what we say is the hospitality gene, it's inside the person. Now, we can grow it. We can train it. We can give them more skills. If we drop them into a poor work environment, we can slowly kill the hospitality gene because they become disinterested and demotivated. Or again, in a great environment, we can grow it. But the one thing we cannot do is insert it. You cannot put something there that doesn't already exist in terms of hospitality. So only as an example, if you're looking for somebody who that's going to fit your culture that needs the hospitality gene, then in the interview process, you're looking for examples of that. And if it's not there, then the rest doesn't matter. The hard skills will not matter. I say that, and I can explain this very quickly on the cruise lines. We were constantly looking for waiters that have the true hospitality gene. There was a push for a while that we needed to find a lot of different waiters with a lot of different language skills. We were having some success in hiring those language skills in Eastern Europe. However, where we were finding was culturally, the Eastern Europeans at times can be a little more closed up. They're very efficient and they do want a service, but there was like a wall. The guests saw that as more cold. And what we learned was we're better to go with people who may not have all the language skills, but have that hospitality gene, because that's ultimately what the guest is going to respond to. And so for the hospitality industry, the hospitality gene is just, it's everything to getting the job done in forward-facing positions.
I think it's fascinating. I'm so glad you brought it up, because that was going to be my next question. And we've all had that experience, right? So if everyone thinks about a time you've gone to a restaurant, you've gone on a cruise if you have, or you've just interacted with somebody, especially in a service-based position, where you know what great feels like. It just feels great. It feels like they actually care, right? Like if you've checked into a hotel, it feels like they care and they want you to have a nice experience. And then we've also had experiences where you're like, do you just hate your job? Like literally, what are you doing here? Either they're missing that gene or it's just a disconnect. It doesn't feel right. And that's just the thing. And I think what's interesting is if we take that hospitality gene, right, and we take that out of the hospitality industry, the cruise lines, and apply that, the lesson I learned a long time ago that a chiropractor friend told me when he recruits new front desk people for his, what he said is hire the smile, train the skill. Because you can't train somebody to have an attitude like that you want and that's a good fit and that would be of service. But you can train skills. Skills are skills, right? Like that's something people, if they have the desire, they can learn. But he said, hire the smile, train the skill. He's looking for someone that has the personalities and that fit, like you're talking about, that gene relative to whatever it is. In sales, it could be that conversational or that nurturing or that getting people to share and open up and solve problems, right? Like maybe for you and your organization, it's a problem solving gene. You need that attitude of curiosity. The one thing you need is curiosity. I'll teach you what to say. I'll give you a script. I'll help you handle objections. Just be curious.
I completely agree with you, but I will tell you that we wrestle with the hiring managers constantly because they've got a long list of hard skills. They want a plug and play employee. And when they're given the perfect resume on paper, if it checks all the hard skill boxes, it's like, yeah, put them in. And they tend not to look at that fit. Now, the smarter ones are the ones that have been burned enough times, start to understand. And what we end up doing over a period of time is whittling down the must list of hard skills and saying, okay, do you really have to have 5 years? If they were such an outstanding person, but had 2 years, well, if they were outstanding, I guess I would accept 2 years. Okay, so let's draw the line at 2 years and not 5 years. And you start to find out what really will make the difference in terms of working with them and working with the client and customers, especially if they're customer forward facing. One of the things that we say in the cruise line, very simply, happy crew, happy guests. It's a direct relationship. If you treat your people well, they're going to treat your guests well. The reverse is also true. How can you treat your people poorly, but beat them daily on the expectation that they need to treat guests well? It's a disconnect. Even logic, you'd say that makes no sense. But it's amazing across all the industries I've been in, where there are taskmasters out there, and it's the old, you know, the beatings will continue until your motivation improves. And
yeah.
It's interesting. And then I have seen this. We talk about, and this cuts across all industries, discretionary effort. What's discretionary effort? Well, this is when an employee is working away and nobody's watching. And it's at the end of the day and they're tired and they've got this one last task or they've got one last guest or there's just something laying there. Now, they could easily just blow it off, put it away, or do they say, you know what? I'm going to stick around and I'm going to take care of this. Or I know the fast answer, but I know the right answer. And I'm going to go the extra mile and I'm going to spend the extra 10, 15 minutes doing that. So the question becomes, how do I access that discretionary effort? Because the employees will say, you got 100% of me. There's nothing left. Well, I'm here to tell you, there's always a little bit left in the tank. There's always a little bit left. And you can't draw on it continuously day after day, but they do have the ability to hit 120%, but you can never push it out of them. You can't force it. You can't beat it out of them. But if they are working in an environment where they're respected, they believe their supervisor, their manager respects them, listens to them, and will help them when they have problems, and they say, hey, when I do well, my boss looks good, and that's good for me, and that's good for them. You know what? I'm going to stick around today and do the extra 30 minutes only because it's so important. Or in the cruise business, I'm not just going to tell that old couple, go down the hallway and make three lefts. And I know they're going to get lost on the way. You know what? I'm tired, but I'm going to walk with them and take them all the way there. And I'll make sure they get where they need to go because that's so important. But that's that discretionary effort. You can't demand it, but you can pull it from your people. But it's all about how you manage folks.
If there's one thing I know, it's that sales is full of failure. Even if you're a Hall of Fame level sales professional, you can make a great income despite losing more than you're winning. If there's one aspect of sales that most people fear and what keeps a lot of people even wanting to get into sales, it's getting hit with objections. That is why I wrote my latest book, The Sales Consultant Guide to Overcoming Objections, Yours and Theirs. This is the first in my new series of short books, guides filled with what you need for helping you improve your selling effectiveness. No fluff, no long-winded stories, no filler to make it seem more valuable, just actual foundation-building strategies to help you become aware of the true nature of why your prospects bring up objections, the different type of objections, and then specific ways to overcome them that are universal to most any sales process, product, service, or style. Go to Amazon.com today and get your copy of A Sales Consultant's Guide to Overcoming Objections. Or if you'd rather, as a gift to the listeners of this podcast, email me at jason@cutterconsultinggroup.com and I'll send you a complimentary full version of it as my thank you for listening and supporting this show. I love it. I think that's great. And regarding that hospitality gene, especially the hard skills that hiring managers think they want, like back to that real quick, is I think it really comes back to what you started with, which was the build versus buy, right? Mm-hmm. Depending on what your strategy is. If you're trying to buy people, then you want to buy those skills and the attitude, but it's going to cost you, right? Like good, fast, or cheap, two out of the three, but never all three, right? Like if you want somebody who's really good on paper and really fast, they're not going to be cheap. It's going to cost you. If you're in a build model, then the soft skills are the ones you want, right? Mm-hmm. That hospitality gene or whatever it is, because you're going to have to build the rest. It's going to take a while and you're going to have to invest in people, right?
Right. Well, the caution I give with the buy model, and lots of companies have a buy model. Hey, so-and-so just left. Well, let's go out. I don't want to spend 6 months or a year to develop someone. Let's go buy them. But think about what we're doing here is you're going out in the open market and assuming you've got a good competitive package, it's almost like securing a mercenary. So you're saying, okay, for X dollars plus what you're making, you come work for us. Now, they'll come and join you and they'll plug and play. In a perfect world, they'll do a good job. But what happens when the next employer comes down 6 months from now or a year from now and offer them a little bit more money again? And so in the buy model, if you don't have anything that makes your company sticky, we refer to sticky, give them reasons to want to stay around, you're likely to see higher turnover with those because they're going to move to the next guy or gal that offers them another dollar an hour or an extra $5,000 for sales or whatever it is. So there are cautions around either strategy. They both work, but they both come at a cost. And I have seen the buy strategy backfire where people just pick up and they move around a certain number of clients and they just keep shuffling around and they get more money each time. And that's not what you want long term, I don't think.
No, and you've got to be careful with that. And it's interesting because I make the relation between sales and selling to customers and relationships and courtship. You can also do it because everything in life is sales to me. And so you look at employee retention as sales and reselling somebody on why they want to be a part of the mission and the vision and the corporation. And so if you're trying to buy the talent, it's now a commodity, which means if somebody gives them a better offer, they're going to go with that, right? Like, hey, I use this paper towel. If I find a cheaper one and I'm not loyal, what do I care? So same thing with companies who try to sell on price to their customers will leave them. Same thing in dating and relationships. If you're trying to buy the affection and love of somebody, if somebody comes across with a better offer, you're going to lose out.
Well, and that's where the question around really comes in. So whether you buy or build, you've got a group of employees. So now the question is, I've made an investment of some sort. How do I retain these employees? One of the things that I still find it hard to believe today people and managers still fail to understand is, first of all, money payroll is not a motivator. It's a hygiene factor. And what do I mean by hygiene? So outside of special compensation, so salespeople have special business bonus programs, et cetera, but most of us don't have that. We'll have a base bonus program or not, and we'll have a compensation salary, hourly rate salary, and then we'll have our benefits. But that in and of itself, it doesn't make it sticky. It's a cost of doing business. It's like paying your electric bill every day or every month to keep the lights on. It's a cost of doing business. Employees don't stick around because of a competitive wage or a competitive benefits package generally. When I mean hygiene, it means if you fall below what is market, then it will become an irritant and it may drive them away. So yes, if you're not paying market, if your benefits package is below, yes, you will have turnover. But when you do make market, it doesn't lend anything to make it more sticky as a company. Again, you're just paying for the lights to get them to come in and keep going. One of the neat things that I found management, when you poll managers and say, okay, tell me of all the people that left in the last year, 2 years, what do you think the primary reason was for their leaving? Studies have shown upwards of 90% of managers will always say it was about the money. They left for money. When you go back and poll the same people that left those organizations and said, why did you leave? About 85% of those people will give you reasons outside of money. It wasn't the money. And this ties back to the supervisors and potentially other hygiene factors. So it could have been salary. It could have been benefits. But you start to find silly things like not having the right equipment. I've also been in the manufacturing sector where They had no clean place to go eat lunch, and every day was just an irritant. But there's all these little things that will add up to that. But generally, they don't leave because of money. Now, many times when companies themselves do the exit surveys, the standard answer a lot of people will give is, well, I left for a better opportunity, more money. They say that because A, they don't want to cause problems. It's typically HR people asking, and they don't want to get crossways with folks. They want to be able to get a good reference from the company. So they're not always as honest about it. There's a trust issue there about explaining it. But when you survey 2, 3, 4 weeks after they've left, you can get a much more honest answer. So it's just a really key learning that if you're suffering from a lot of turnover and you're hearing it's all about the money, okay, if you're not paying industry rates, you need to. But that in itself isn't going to improve your retention. You've got other things you need to do. And don't keep blaming it off on the money. There's more to it than that.
And I just want to reiterate something you said towards the end there, because this is such an important tip. And you have a tip that you didn't even mention there that I want people to understand. If you have a turnover situation that you're concerned about, whether it's a problem or not, or you just want to address it, right? Like a good salesperson that actually wants to know why they lost the sale, they want to ask that person who didn't buy so that they can improve. If that's your culture and you actually want to fix any level of turnover that you have, right? Doesn't have to be world's on fire. Like you said, is poll people and do that exit interview, but post exit. So there's not that barrier where they're worried about burning the bridge because you don't want to do it. And then the other thing that you've told me that I know that you support is also hiring a third party company to do that poll. So it's not you and they're just telling it. And then you'll get honest feedback. Hopefully you're prepared for it, but it'll be very honest.
Right. What we have found is when you talk to a company representative, people are a little bit anxious to say things. And then the next thing is, even if it's in an email, people are hesitant to sit and type something out because there's a fear that there's a permanent record. But you get a third party. Yes, I've been hired from your former company. We just want to have a chat with you on the phone. We just want 10 minutes of your time at a time that's convenient for you. People will be much more open to talk and say because they don't think it's as permanent. Now, of course, at the other end, we're taking notes and they're feeding it back to us as a company. But it's just the nature of people. They're more open to that. But let's take this concept a step further, because exit interviews can tell you some things and you can take that and maybe translate it back into your business to say, okay, before we lose any more people, here's some things we might want to consider. But these same third-party companies, and you can do this internally as well, is why aren't you polling your people after the first 30 days, the first 60 days, the first 90 days? Find out how your people are doing in the onboarding process, because there's a lot of failures in the onboarding process. And most of the time, they're relatively simple things, but they can lend to turnover in those opening months or the first year. Wouldn't it be great to get some of that feedback early? So not only can we save that employee, but we can potentially also save other employees. Exit interviews are rear view. We've already lost that resource. There's still some learning to gain, but what about doing interviews with the new hires? And then we get into engagement surveys with employee groups in total to say, well, if you're brave enough and interested enough to really understand what your people are thinking, go poll them. But be careful, if you're going to poll them, you need to be prepared to act on it. If you're just going to ask their opinion and not do anything with it, you're probably best not to ask. And you'd be surprised the number of companies that they say they do employee surveys, but then they don't do anything with it. And in fact, again, it becomes another hygiene factor where the employees are going, are you kidding me? You're asking me to take another freaking survey again? And you didn't act on the last time I told you there was a problem. Other companies will say, well, look, when it's done well, the employees will say, well, you know what? Yeah, I got a few things that I'm not happy with, but I have seen some improvements in some areas and they do seem to listen. And some things are not so easy to fix. Other things are. But again, that gets to the stickiness of an organization, that if your authentic leadership says, we care about what you think, we can't fix everything, but we hear some common themes, we'll come in and fix them for you. Here's something simple. If you look at most of the industry in North America, 85, 90% of all people sit down the majority of the day. The ergonomics of sitting in a chair comfortably that's been well designed versus a cheap chair, there's estimates that we lose $500 million due to just poor ergonomics. Now, I'm not sure how they derive that number, but you're an expert. I'm an expert. I sit all day. And I can tell you the difference between a comfortable chair and something that's not. So if your employees are saying, I'm not asking for more money, could I get a more ergonomically well-designed workstation? Can I get a better seat? I've walked through some very expensive offices and I see torn seats and broken seats and saying somebody's sitting in that for 8, 9, 10 hours a day. Doesn't the supervisor or manager care? It's not always the big things. It's the little things that matter as well. Keep your eyes open for those things.
Which is so fascinating because I've been in several organizations where maybe it's finally time to upgrade the chairs. Or I can remember a few individuals who just bought their own chairs and they were so excited and so happy or got some credit towards it. And again, sitting all the time, right? It's these little things. A lot of companies just think, okay, we got to give them more money. It's like, no. And it also doesn't mean we need to do free food in the kitchen, right? Maybe it's not that. It's like, what is it for them? And I think that's so important. And back to your comment about asking for feedback and then actually doing something with it. I mean, that's the old comment box outside of HR, the manager's things, where it's like people are putting those in, nothing's changing. Eventually, people are just going to give up on giving feedback because it doesn't seem like you care. And it's about doing something with it if you do. The one caveat that I've learned, and I took this from Cy Wakeman, and she has several books. One's called No Ego. I forget what the other one is. In her books, what she talks about is making sure you're careful of who you listen to that give you feedback. Because if you have, especially salespeople, I have somebody who's not performing, not closing deals, they're going to have everybody to blame but themselves. If I act on their feedback, then I'm listening to essentially the losers on the team for the direction I drive the company. So you want to put more weight in the top performers or people who you respect because of the work they're providing in any department and being like, okay, if they're saying this, then I want to put those things in place. But it's hard because if you just open a survey to everybody and the winners and the losers in a department based on performance, the losers, they're probably going to keep yelling and saying, well, you guys just don't care. It's like, we just don't care about your opinion.
Let me tell you a great little story. This is years ago. I was working in a manufacturing company, very large. I'm not going to mention the name. We had a large sales meeting and there was probably 400 or 500 salespeople in the room. And it had been somewhat of a tough year. And there were some issues, as there is in every organization. So the head of sales started to run a list of things. And then the president got up. And he took over writing on the easel all the things that were wrong. This went on for like 30 minutes and give me a list of everything that you need to have done right. And so I'm sitting on the stage because I'm about to present a new package to them about their variable comp. And I'm thinking, okay, the president's doing this. Where is this going? And 15 minutes in, I'm going, okay, this isn't going to end well. So he's got like 5, 6 charts. There's 40, 50 things. And then he finally says to the group, okay, have we got everything? And I'm saying, yeah, that's it. So then he looks at him and says, okay, guys, let me tell you this. I see your list. If I can get all this done for you, I don't need any of you because it will sell itself. So pray to God that I don't ever get through this list. He did then say, okay, now I'm going to circle 4 or 5 things on this list that I think are valid and I think they will help you. And we're going to work on that. But hope I never complete this list. And then it was like, okay, Eric, come on up and give them the new comp program. And I was like, okay. So you could have heard a pin drop in that room because nobody said a word. But his point was made. If it sells itself, I don't need you. So to your point, there's always going to be objections. There's always going to be hurdles in the industry. Some of it can be corrected. Some of it can be improved. And some of it, suck it up, buttercup. That's how it works. Or find another job. It was an interesting event, let me tell you. I still remember it vividly.
I bet. So I want to go back to what you were talking about onboarding, because you and I have talked and I see retention, right? Let's look at the positive word, which is I want to have a strong retention, strong culture, have people who are on board, stickiness of my organization and the people on the team. So we talked about recruiting, right? And then there's onboarding. And I want you to share your perspective on the value of onboarding, where onboarding is missed in organizations, what can be done in that chain that we're leading towards to this retention kind of environment.
Right. I was reading some studies from 2018 and 2019, and their findings were that almost 50% of all new hires that fail within the first 18 months point to onboarding where companies fail. And what do we mean by that? Well, It could be they didn't get sufficient information and sufficient training, and that's relatively easy to fix. But generally, it comes down to some other things. When we say onboarding, were they greeted? Did they feel that they were wanted? Did the supervisor or manager welcome them that day? Did they give them the time to introduce folks? I've been in some very large companies where it takes sometimes days or a week or two to get somebody's computer access and all the different things that are required. And it's very frustrating for folks. And they're sitting there saying, well, I joined what I thought was a great company, but here I feel like I'm being ignored. And it can be disconcerting. And what happens in that first week, first 30 days are so critical. You've gone to all the trouble to hire this person and they're enthusiastic on day one. What you want to do is ride that wave up with them. But many times through smaller things, we actually demotivate them because things aren't prepared. Managers are so busy, they don't have time. They say hi, shake hands and say, there's your desk and away you go. And we fail at some of the simple things. People think onboarding is some big, grandiose activity. In some organization, it is. But it's not putting in an hour-long video from marketing talking about the company and its culture to say, okay, you've now been onboarded. It's nice, but it's the people connection. And are you investing with these people? It's in conjunction with HR sometimes. Sometimes it's all on the hiring manager. But you've got to ensure that first day, the first week, the first month are special for that employee. And that's what all the studies say, because people will lose energy in a matter of weeks, if not days, if it goes poorly. And on the other hand, if it goes well, you'll see them building up. And then when there are problems, they'll overcome it. But don't overlook the importance of small things on the first day or the first week. I always tell managers, unless they've got a high volume shop, try and take your employee out to lunch at the end of the first week on Friday. Hey, how did the week go? What did you learn? What did you see? Any surprises? What's frustrating you? What can I help you with? Pull them, take that pulse. And again, there's only one first day and one first week. Make an effort, show. You'd be surprised what little effort means to people. We see that when we walk around and I look in cubicles and what's posted. And yes, they've got lots of personal pictures. But again, when you see handwritten notes from supervisors or a manager or someone else in the organization, that's what gets up. Not the corporate HR letter that says, congratulations on your 1 year, fill in the blank, and here's your little Chotsky pin. I mean, I get why we do that, but that doesn't connect people. No. But if the manager walks over with a handwritten card that took all of 30 seconds, even if corporate gave it to them, but they sat down, dated it, and wrote a personal comment about, I really enjoy working with you and your attention to detail is just outstanding and we're really lucky to have you. How long did that take to write? That little authentic note will get posted up on that and it becomes a badge of courage they're proud of to show. And it's not about the big grandiose gestures. It's the gestures that make sense. They have to be authentic and they need to be recurring, not just once a year. You try to do that whenever you can.
Yeah. And I think that onboarding piece is so important. The biggest thing that I have noticed that leads to that failure in the onboarding is that people forget what it was like when they were new. And so they forget that experience, right? They forget being the new kid in school or their first time going to camp and what that experience was like. And they've been doing it for so long. They've been at the organization for a year, 2 years, 10 years. It's like they just literally can't remember and can't connect. And so they're not walking in that person's shoes. And I think that's always the biggest thing to remember. And here's an analogy I love to use, and I'm so glad that you're talking about this stuff, is we've all had this experience. You're excited to go to a restaurant, right? You found out about this restaurant. You're super excited to go. You're standing in the lobby of the restaurant, the entrance. There's nobody around. Finally, the host comes. Seems like maybe they hate their job. They seat you to a table. 5, 10, 15 minutes go by. Maybe you have water. Maybe you don't. You see the server running around, but they still haven't said hi to you. You're just like, hey, like, can we at least get drinks or something? Maybe they run by and say, hey, I'm really busy, but I'll be back. Like, we've all had that experience. Everyone knows what that's like. That sucks. And they can try to turn it around. I've seen some people turn it around because I could tell, like, their world was on fire, but then they made it up to me. Usually not. That's the first impression. I'm not going back. That's
You're not going back.
I'm not, and I'm not going to tell anybody to go to it because I don't want anyone else to suffer through that. And that's literally what I've seen organizations do, like you're describing, to their first day employees, where it's I'm sorry, we don't have a computer for you. I'll be back in like an hour. I have a meeting. It's like, this sucks. I don't want to come back here again.
Now, one of the solutions that some companies have found, and again, it depends on the type of company and not everybody can do this, but we'll assign a buddy. So again, here goes to the stickiness. So you take an existing employee who's a good or great performer, who's got that love of working and training and working and developing relationships with people. Again, it's an innate DNA thing. They feel good about, wow, the company thinks well enough of me to push me out as an ambassador. And for the next week or for the next month, I'm going to check in with this person every day or every other day to see, what can I answer? Is there anything you need? Those types of things. And again, it can be very informal, but you give them a connection and someone to talk with, as long as it's the right person, and it works well. One of the examples that I talk about in my discussion paper I put together was the two examples of two different companies trying to do something like an appreciation day. It was tough financial years. And so there wasn't a great deal of money in the one company. They had held raises for a couple of years. They even froze 401k, et cetera. They had thought the right thing to do was to throw a lavish Christmas party. So it was big Christmas party at a country club, very expensive, shrimp cocktail, all the big. And it completely bombed. Some of us had counseled them on this, but the optics were completely wrong. And people were actually upset by this, saying, I would rather have it in my salary. This is a waste of time. Why are we doing this? It's just wrong. And it was like, Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake. And university was panned by the employees. So a great deal of money and complete waste. Same kind of situation, different company. And they said, look, we don't really have a lot of money, but I think we have reasonably good, authentic managers and leadership, and we care. So what we decided to do is we set up one morning, all the managers, senior leadership came in early. And the idea was all the facilities across the entire U.S. and Canada was to meet people, pour them cups of coffee, offer them donuts, and just chat with them for a couple of minutes and just say, thank you. We really sincerely appreciate all you did. So look, what is the cost of a donut or two and a cup of coffee in leadership's time to say thank you? Reasonably nothing, minimal. But because it was perceived as authentic, it got rave reviews. Now, there's always a few people that always get nasty about everything, but that's not the group we're going after. We're going after the majority. And it was really, really well received. And it just showed to me, it's not about the money. It's about the authenticity and what you're trying to accomplish. People appreciated the fact that some of the other facilities, people were coming in as early as 5 a.m. and some were coming back in at 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night so they could meet late shift employees. And it wasn't about the cup of coffee or the donut. It was the fact that they took the time and they were showing people they cared, they were listening, and they said, thank you. What is the cost of doing that? My goodness. And that, again, it gets to that stickiness issue. People try to overthink this sometimes. Don't overthink it. Do what you can with the resources you have, but act. Do something. I like your quote in your book in the preface, try not, do or do not. There is no try. The reference to Yoda, but stop worrying about trying. Go do it. You may not always get the results you want, but I tell you, employees will generally, if it's authentic and they know it was sincere, you'll always get credit for it. Maybe you won't get as much as you want, but you'll get some. It also has a cumulative effect. Ask a woman, would you like to get 2 dozen roses on Valentine's Day, or would you prefer to get 1 rose once a month? Now, guys, we're doing the math going, hey, give me the 2 dozen roses. You know, I'm being stereotypical here. But most women will say, no, I want the rose once a month. And the watch is not just for women, but for men. Having those little check-ins of authenticity, say, I'm thinking about you once a month, is much more telling and much more impressive and sticky than the big event once a year with your wife or your spouse, giving them a dozen roses. So think in those terms. And it's not always what can the corporation do? What can you do as a manager? Well, I have no money. I can't do that. Well, I walk around with a cup of coffee every morning when I saw my team. I got to know everybody's name. I could tell who was having a good day, who was a bad day. And just walking, I can tell you in the beginning, people are going, oh my God, what's he doing? Why do they have a vice president walking around? There must be a problem. And then after a few weeks, they started to realize he's okay. He doesn't bite. And when I asked him, how are you doing? I actually do care. And whenever somebody would say, look, I'm really frustrated with this, I would try to help out. Either I could solve it, or I'd get their supervisor involved, or we'd try to make something better. But it's those little things of walking around and showing, that's what makes sticky. That's what buys retention. It's not all about the money, and it's not about the grand gestures. So I say that to any manager who says, well, I don't have the money and the budget to do these things. Yes, you do. Yes, you do, my friend. Get up and talk to your people and engage with them in a sincere manner and give them little notes or whatever it takes to pass that message on to them.
And the biggest thing I take away from that I've seen is it the intention of doing things to make sure your people understand they're appreciated and you're trying to relay and impart even more of the corporate culture and your personal feelings and leadership into them, right? Servant leadership, that kind of thing. Or are you checking boxes from a leadership perspective, which is, okay, make sure I appreciate them. All right, get country club, throw party, hand out shrimp cocktails, right? And I've seen that even with food. It's like, I got to check the box. I got to do something nice for you. So here's some donuts I left in the break room because I checked the box, right? And that's really what it comes down to is even the party at the country club, if it's a different intention, not just checking boxes, it can also be amazing, but it's usually unnecessary. The little things would be more, but again, it's just the heart and the spirit. I've seen owners who are like, what do we have to do to keep people happy? All right, here's this money. Just go do it. Like whatever it is, just check those boxes and do it. And it just falls flat, right?
Yeah, to your point, I have worked with people in the manufacturing industry that don't even have high school diplomas. And I've dealt with master's degrees and PhDs. And every single one of them, to the guy that doesn't or the gal that doesn't have the high school, they're smart people. Do not underestimate them. And they have a built-in radar and they can smell when you're not being truthful and authentic. So if you're just going to throw a box of donuts at the break room once in a while, best don't do it. They'll eat them, but it won't mean anything. But you said, I was thinking about you guys. I saw this special bagel shop and I went out of my way and I brought in a couple dozen. And I think it's kind of neat. Let me know what you think because I was thinking about you. The smart salespeople, I'll tell you, in several of the companies I worked at, they would come to the corporate headquarters and the smart ones always brought gifts for the customer service reps when they go to the call center and say, you sons of a guns. But damn right, they'd go in there and they knew the people that were servicing their regions and they always brought in little authentic gifts, you know, little $5, $10, little tchotchke things. But it was given with some heart and they have a relationship with those people and those people fell over backwards. And then when that salesperson would call in to get some help or needed something, they'd bust to help them. So there's a real quid pro quo there if it's authentic. If you truly are thankful and grateful for people for what they do, whether it be from the most senior to the most junior, they'll do things. One company, it was at Club Med, and I went in for the interview and I showed up about 5 minutes early, not too early, but you don't want to be just on time. So I'm sitting there and it's 10 minutes after, then it's 15 minutes after. And it's like, what's going on? So I checked with the receptionist. She said, no, they're aware that you're here. 25 minutes after. And then I finally got in. This was the CFO at the time, but this was a test to see how I would treat junior people. I was being interviewed for a senior level leadership position, but he used this little game of making people wait, find out how they treated students, and then have that report back to him before we even started the interview. It was a test of character, but it was a way of testing their hospitality gene in a very interesting way because they wanted authentic people that cared. So even under frustrating circumstances of being made to wait, how did they behave to the receptionist and how did they behave themselves? I guess I didn't think about it, but I just chatted her up and it's okay. We can reschedule. I'll come back. It'll work. And she smiled at me and said, no, let me go talk to them. Of course, she went back and reported to say, no, he's very pleasant, but they had ruled out people at the reception desk, if you can believe that or not. Now, I'm not saying others should do that, but that was a way of them sorting out the hospitality gene and the engagement gene. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
I think that's always a good test. It's always good to see people in their natural environment and how they're going to behave, because I think that's so true. So, Eric, thank you for your time. Thanks for coming here. I love all the stuff you shared. I hope it helps organizations, leaders, business owners, with their retention, with everything to look at in the cycle. Also for people as employees and looking at what do you want from your company? What's a good fit for you? Because it's your life as well. What is being a good candidate and how that is? So much valuable stuff. Eric, what's the best way for someone to reach out to you or see what you're doing? If they like this stuff and they want to find out more from you, where's the best place to go?
Just send me an email. I'd be delighted to respond. It's Eric, E-R-I-C-L-W Stewart at gmail.com. I'm a little consulting company, but we've dealt with some big issues and there's nothing too big or too small. I enjoy it all. It's fun to work that way. So reach out to me and I'll be happy to chat with you.
Perfect. So Eric L.W. Stewart at gmail.com.
Yep.
Got it. Eric, thanks again for being here. I really appreciate it. And I'm super excited to keep these conversations going. So thank you for being here.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Jason. God bless and all the best to everybody who's listening.
Thanks for tuning into the Authentic Persuasion Show. If you found value in this episode, please do two things. Subscribe so you can get each new episode and share this episode with anyone else you know in sales. Together, we can help shift the way sales is done. And if you want to find out more information about how to transform your sales career, or you want help with shifting your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, go to jasoncutter.com. Don't forget that everything in life is sales, and I will catch you on the next episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show.